So my name is Bárbara Rodríguez Muñoz and I'm curator at the Wellcome Collection.
It's really lovely to sit with you, Bárbara. I wondered if you could begin by taking us on a journey through Making a Voice.
Yeah, of course. And thank you very much for coming. So with this exhibition, we wanted to explore the complex physiology and psychology of both producing voice but also receiving voice or voices. And we wanted to do this through a mainly acoustic experience in the gallery space. So what you see, what visitors see, what they hear when they enter this exhibition is a series of open spaces in which we are playing with sound bleed. And sound becomes, in a way, the tool that you can use to navigate the exhibition. So perhaps you have noticed that sometimes you hear an artwork before you actually see the artwork. So the idea was to create this space for perceiving and receiving voices and to kind of understand kind of this relationship or this experience. And in order to be able to work with sound bleed and to kind of reflect the importance of sound and performance in the exhibition, we decided with the architects, Platt, we decided to kind of expose all the acoustic materials that are usually hidden. So kind of like the foams that you see on the walls and kind of the carpets and so on. So as you come in this kind of performative acoustic journey, as you come in, you start with an anechoic chamber, which is a space that absorbs sounds, and it creates kind of like a transition space from the very busy Euston Road and the very busy cafe at the Wellcome Collection into a perhaps a non-visual kind of experience. So it kind of prepares you for that. So you enter through the anechoic chamber, and when you leave, you donate your voice to an ever-evolving kind of archive of visitors' voices, which is a commission with composer Matthew Herbert that we developed with the Royal Opera House. So you start by kind of absorbing all the sounds, and you leave by donating your own voice in the exhibition. And in the way, there are five main sections, which are kind of loose. It's not a chronological exhibition. It's quite loose, so the sections merge into each other. But the exhibition is mainly trying to understand the voice from a non-linguistic kind of approach. With that, I mean, try to understand the emotions and the meaning that is conveyed through the voice, through its melody and its prosody, and things like tempo and rhythm and pitch and volume and what that says, regardless of the words, before the words, beyond the words. So kind of outside language. And it's a division that is not always so easy to kind of make, the division between language and voice, but we try to do that. So that was kind of the main kind of objective of the exhibition, if I could say, to look at the voice and the emotions that resonate in the voice and its melody with our language. So like, for example, Joan LaBarbera's Circular Song, which is the vocalist's kind of in this repeating loop of inhales and exhales and inhales and exhales. It's a very physical experience, and I think when you are under the dome, you can really feel it like that. But then also we needed to use headphones, and we were quite worried to have too many headphones in the exhibition. So then they came up with these other solutions, like the sound cones, like the single headphone kind of sound cone that looks like an ice cream. Yeah, that kind of thing.
I like that the form and function of the materials that you chose actually make so much sense with the journey of the exhibition.
Well, it was important because the voice is something non-physical. So we were asked to curate an exhibition on something non-physical, which is quite difficult. So this idea of kind of revealing the process of producing voice, revealing the mechanisms of voice production, but also revealing AV equipment that is used in sound exhibitions and the materials that are used to absorb sound, the idea was kind of to make all that transparent. Themes in the exhibition. So one of them is this idea of hearing voices that others don't hear, which is something that we're trying to put in a wider cultural, historical contexts, as opposed to a pathological one. So, for example, we have this beautiful painting by Waterhouse of Orpheus, and that's representing or is depicting the head of Orpheus when he's disembodied and separated kind of from the body, and it carries on singing. So this idea of a voice that can come out of nowhere, or the voice of God, kind of these two amazing manuscripts from the British Library that narrate the experiences of these mystics from the 14th century that could hear the voice of God or feel the presence of God. So we wanted to put the experience of hearing voices into that context. So that's one of the difficult kind of themes that we are exploring with this exhibition. And then there is also this idea of kind of voice pathologies, and like you can see, for example, in Imogen Stithworthy film Alex, where you see this patient that has a psychosomatic voice disorder and is getting this kind of manual therapy in order to kind of heal the voice. And it is quite a strong experience. So it was important for us to present these works in a kind of non-pathological way, in a sensitive way. So I never wanted the exhibition to be distressful, and it could have been distressful because of the amount of sound. So that was very important, to control the sound bleed and not create a space that people will leave feeling distressed because there are some difficult topics. And I think that in Beckett's Not I, kind of the mouth, the main character, the actress, is she can hear a voice that the audience cannot hear, and she's kind of responding to that voice, but also delivering this kind of a stream of consciousness that seems to be coming from somewhere else, and we don't know where that's coming from. We don't know if it's a traumatic experience, or we don't know what she... Yeah, so her mouth is kind of, in a way, for me, acting as some sort of kind of channel for somebody else's voice. This idea of the commanding voice, the voice of God, and the voice that tells you what to do, is quite present in the exhibition, in some of the works in the exhibition. I think it's especially present in the short clip from The Wizard of Oz, right? When Dorothy and the friends arrive to finally meet and greet and the kind of wonderful Wizard of Oz. And and then it's revealed that he's a fragile man, that kind of voice is not... It's not real. He's just a fragile man, and that kind of empowers the group, which is something that I think relates very nicely with the work we were discussing before, the avatar therapy. That's how it works. It's about confronting the voice. It's about being able to talk back to that commanding voice. And for I think Katharina Thekla's film is quite a political work, and it's a very important work in the exhibition. It relates to the relationship between voice and identity, and how the voice can locate us socially and geographically, and what are the politics around that. So in the film, we see a migrant worker who is getting this accent removal lesson in Birmingham, as it could perhaps help his chances of finding work. So the piece is, in a way, like Birmingham is well known for its strong accent. So for me, the piece is about this kind of impossibility of a non-accent kind of condition.
So Helen Keller was someone I hadn't known of before, but a remarkable woman, an incredible woman. Could you tell us a little bit about her life, about the piece of work that we see in the show, and really kind of how revolutionary that practice was that she was doing?
Yeah, so she was working with her tutor, Anne Sullivan, who spent so many years with her as a tutor, and they develop, redevelop, because it was a technique that had been used previously, but this way of communicating with each other, or this language, for Helen Keller, because Helen Keller lost her sight and also lost her voice, and she was also deaf. So this technique consists on Helen placing one of her hands in the kind of larynx area, so she can feel the vibrations of the vocal cords, and then the other hand on the lips of the speaker, so she can lip read. And in this way, she learned to communicate. And then she went on and studied and did her BA and was an extremely successful kind of person. There is a work by an artist called Anika Danik, and the work is titled Emily. And in the film we see a girl who doesn't have a voice, but she's still learning to sing with expression, and she's attending this singing lesson in which this, again, acousmatic commanding voice of the teacher is training her to use her gaze and to use her hands and to use her expression in order to communicate, in order to kind of, yeah, create some sort of meaning or emotion. Needs to take this accent removal lesson in order to kind of improve his chances of finding work. And he's doing this in a city in Birmingham, which is a city that is well known by its accent. So for me, that's, as I say, a very strong kind of political piece and something I can relate to. I also have an accent and also came from other parts of Europe. So... And then in relation to the avatar is I never thought about them in relation, but I guess the avatar is has something quite radical about it, because it's a research project and it's being kind of conducted by psychologists, but is trying not to kind of erase the voices of voice hearers, which is kind of, It seems to be, at least in Western society, that if you hear voices that others don't hear, then that's wrong and you need to try to remove them in the same way that perhaps you remove your accent, right? But instead, what this therapy is doing is to helping them to manage those voices and to take control of those voices and what those voices say to them. It was important for us to kind of... present how producing voice animates a whole body. It's not just about kind of your respiratory system and kind of your articulators and kind of your vocal cords, but it's about the whole body. It's a physical exercise and it can be straining and it, as you say, kind of it needs endurance.
Birdsong being something that is learnt. Birds learn to sing from their surroundings, and the idea of him working with people to teach them how to sing birdsong. I wondered, are there any other works in the show that there's that same relationship with the sound of nature or
I think the Louis Arno collection, which comes from the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford. So Louis Arno is a musicologist, and he's been living with the Bakayan communities in Central Africa for, I think, over 30 years, and recording the soundscapes of the communities living in the forests. What I think is extraordinary about the Bakaya community's song is how the individuals are able to kind of attune their voices to the rest of the community and kind of interlock their voices and do call and response, and through a combination of whistling and kind of high-pitched voices and animal mimicking. But then also they attune their voice to the forest sounds and to the kind of soundscape. To experience that work in relation to people like Joan LaBarbera and Meredith Monk, this kind of non-conventional sounds that can be incorporated in singing practices, that they are non-verbal and they're kind of, it's a combination of kind of inhales and exhales and kind of groans and perhaps sounds that are, we share with the animal world, and sounds that are not so kind of connected to a cultural context, but there is perhaps something more universal about them or more unconscious.
So the work in the show by Emma Smith invites the audience to participate in the co-production of a new language and through this language school. How's do you feel the public have engaged with that invitation?
So, yeah, as I mentioned before, I think it's working really nicely. People are like... doing their homework, learning the language, and then practicing with each other. And Emma Smith has been part of the Voicings program again, and she's been in the space learning and rehearsing the language with our visitors. But I think there is something about that piece that it is a language school and it's about education, but I believe it's also about unlearning. So the piece is following this theory coming from anthropology that says that perhaps we were singing to each other before we were... talking to each other, so basically using the voice for emotional bonding before we were using it for kind of this productive communication, exchange, that is language, that is modern language. So thinking about the evolution of the human voice and a potential parallel kind of type of evolution of the human voice based on social bonding. So again, I think, as I was saying before, there is something very challenging and quite political about it, this non-productive language that gives more importance to emotional communication rather than to kind of effective, kind of delivering an effective message.